Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the Robot Industry Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to advanced manufacturing, capital equipment, and the robotics and automation industry. My name is Jim Beretta, and I am your host. Lyle has worked as a project manager and application engineer in several automation companies and has experience working in automotive, pharmaceutical, food processing, lab instrumentation, and retail printing industries. So he's had a wide variety of synergistic technologies, which undoubtedly has given him a big variety of product process and automation knowledge. Welcome to the podcast, Lyle, and we're happy to have you in our series.
Good morning, Jim, and I appreciate you having me.
Today's podcast is about the steps that you need to develop an automation system. And since at Earhart, you're experts in assembly automation and robotics and tooling, and in lean automation, so it's a very good fit. So Lyle, let's talk about some of the steps involved in building an automation system. And I often think of the build of an automation system as a bubble that moves through the shop. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I mean, you have some distinct phases of a project that occur from, you know, design, and then things start to be released to machine and fabrication groups for custom details to be machined and manufactured and fabricated. And that sometimes can occur over a period of time where we're releasing things as they become available from engineering or some, you know, so that bubble becomes a little bit elongated and a little more fluid. And then other times it may be an all at once release, and then that bubble is more rounded and, you know, not quite as fluid and elongated. But yes, it definitely moves through as a bubble and, you know, in definite stages through assembly and then on to debug and testing.
In our pre-call, one of the things that Earhart is really good at is lean automation. But for today's example, we're going to use an example of a multi-station automated system. We in the industry call it a line, and often they're a straight line or a big oval, but we still call it a line. And the word probably came from like the automotive industry, right? Where Henry Ford started the system where it really was a line and the final product simply rolled off the line. But I wanted you to maybe give the audience some definitions of some of the key parts of an automation system and maybe explain what some of these items are that they may be unfamiliar with, especially if they've never bought an automation system before.
Sure. And yeah, so one of the key components, one of the things that is usually at the core of every automation system is a PLC, which is an acronym for Programmable Logic Controller. These are industrial computer systems designed specifically for controlling machines and processes. You know, states of input devices are monitored. Decisions are made in the CPU, and based on programmed evaluation of these states, we're going to derive connected output devices. So essentially, you have, you know, the main parts of a PLC are the, you know, it has a power source, it has a rack for installing input modules and output modules. So those are the main components. PLCs have been around for about 50 years, and so they've developed, you know, as with anything, been around that long. Today's PLCs are capable of a whole lot of capability that, you know, initially was not there. You know, and you're able to have digital I/O, which is essentially an on or off state, and we're just detecting whether it's on or whether it's off. And then we also have analog capability where you can detect a voltage range or an amperage range and make decisions based on that. Coupled with PLCs, another key component that is kind of a foundational item for automation is an HMI, which is also an acronym for Human Machine Interface. And today's HMIs are programmable control panels, is essentially that replace the many of the push button and pilot light features of the past. You know, we still see some of those. You know, we don't have e-stop buttons, for example, are still a hardwired button that is not part of an HMI controllable panel. You know, here's, you know, this is the area where an operator will go and the main hub of things where he can initiate, pause, halt, and monitor the actions going on within the automation or the equipment that he's operating. You know, here's where we would see messages displayed about machine faults, process steps, machine status, you know, things of that nature. Another key item or foundational item we talk about are parts feeders. Part feeders are generally, you know, generally speaking, are the devices that transfer parts or subassemblies to an automation cell for processing. You know, these could take the form of conveyors, either powered or gravity fed. Vibratory feeder bowls are a very common item for feeding, especially smaller component parts. Screws into a screwdriving operation are very, very, very common for a feeder application. We also have things like destacker mechanisms, which may take a vertical stack of components and singulate them for processing and feed into an automation process. Another item we often talk about or run into are test stations. Test stations are something along the line that might verify specific aspects of the assembly or the process. Common automated test stations are leak testing, vacuum decay or pressure decay leak testing, electrical characteristics, we might check continuity, voltage, et cetera, things like that. You know, we also may have functional tests where we take an assembly and connect to it and do some functional tests, say on a pump or something of that nature. Another foundational building block item that we want to define for you is end-of-arm tooling, sometimes referred to as EOAT. And these are the devices or mechanisms that attach to the end of the robot, to the robot wrist, and that actually perform the process or gives the robot functionality. This might be a pneumatic or electrically powered gripper, a series of vacuum cups for handling, material removal tools, welding torches. These might all be examples of end-of-arm tooling for a robot. We also have quick change tools available to allow for seamless change from one tool to a different tool to handle a variety of parts or processes that the robot need to perform. There's other parts of end-of-arm tooling, such as collision sensors, that also exist to help protect the equipment and the process. Another item we want to define up front here is machine vision. Machine vision systems now are a camera, the lighting, and a vision controller, and that package altogether becomes your machine vision system. With machine vision, images are taken and analyzed by the vision controller, and then they provide feedback to either the PLC or potentially to a robot controller. It's very common now to have machine vision integrated directly into robots, and the robot suppliers are doing a really good job of having those packages immediately available that are integrated and interfaced to their particular controller. 2D machine vision systems are commonly used to inspect part quality, part presence, maybe part orientation, things of that nature. And we also, 3D machine vision has taken some big strides here in recent years and helped to develop a whole new bin picking automation concept, which is essentially a bin full of parts in random fashion, not oriented or located in any way, and we're able to take a 3D picture of that and then coordinate the robot to go and pick up parts from that bin, you know, until it's empty. We also have machine vision, especially in the 2D version, useful in adaptive processes such as conveyor tracking, where parts are running down, let's say, a belt conveyor, and they're not located or oriented in any way, shape, or form, but the robot can track those along the conveyor and pick them up on the fly. Guarding is also another item we want to define, and it's a key element to any automation system because we need to make sure we practice safe methods for protecting operators and peripheral personnel from the hazards of machine motion or hazards created by the process. You know, we might have, if we're doing a material removal process, chips, welding, we have arc flash and things of that nature that we need to protect machine operators and, you know, somebody that may be just passing by the cell. So guarding could become a physical barrier, whether it be a wire mesh type fencing, solid physical barriers in some cases. We also have light curtains and area sensors that can all be incorporated and integrated and have their own uses within automation cells for providing that safety and protection for the operator and peripheral personnel. You know, as automation integrators, we work with these items on a daily basis. So we have, you know, the skill and the experience that maybe a customer just getting into automation or doesn't really have the same sort of experiences that we have. It also affords us an opportunity. Our purchasing power may be greater on some of these items as well, in that our volumes are greater than say someone who has not been involved in, you know, doing automation and purchasing these types of components.
Those are good. Some good points. Thanks, Lyle. You know, I totally agree. The fact that a big company like Johnson & Johnson, they probably have all the things in their company, like robot programming and industrial designers and sensor programmers and all these other talents, but to be able to put them on the same job at the same time, exactly when they need them to be busy, is really, really, it's almost impossible.
Yes. And I think there are some companies, and some of the larger automotive companies as well, have, you know, talented engineers and maintenance personnel that could do these types of things. But what I have experienced over the years and had this communicated directly from those guys is they have other jobs that are full-time jobs. And so often these integration projects or automation projects become a part-time job for them. And you know how it goes when you're doing something as part-time. It doesn't get your full attention. You're not as efficient at your regular full-time job. And so your full-time job gets shortchanged and you don't give the full attention or due to the automation part-time thing that you're doing. So, you know, that's where I think integrators can be useful to customers, especially customers who aren't maybe as big and don't have some of that experience and talent on board that some of the larger companies may have.
And one of the big challenges, Lyle, too, is time to market so critical for these companies. So if they don't need it for 2 years, maybe they can do it drip by drip. But it's so much easier to get an integrator involved. They have a start date and a stop date and a delivery date, and it's all a lot more organized. Hey, let's talk about how you get started with a customer around automation. To me, often it happens when a customer, like, they land a contract or a bid for a program to produce a part, say like an automotive small motor pump. Is that usually what happens?
Yeah, I think that's a lot of times that is the case. A customer is either bidding on some new work, a new part that they're going to bring in for production, or they're expanding an existing production line to add a new model year or something of that nature, or you have customers who just are becoming less cost competitive in their particular market, and they need to figure out a way to be more cost competitive. We also have considerations where you have safety and ergo concerns. The parts are large, they're difficult, they're heavy, or they're awkward to handle. You know, other things may be that a customer has developed some part quality issues, so they need to figure out a way to solve some of their quality issues through automation. You know, we mentioned before a little bit about manufacturing costs, and there's always, we need to have this mindset of continuous improvement, because there's always somebody else out there trying to get better. So for us, the earlier in the process we can get involved with the customer, the better, I think, for everybody. So if we can get involved when that customer is quoting to bring a new product into their facility, if we can collaborate with them at that point, I think we can mutually understand the process and the expectations and come up with a solution that, you know, tailor an automation solution that's going to best meet their needs and which allows them to become as competitive as possible in winning that new work. And then I think just things just flow a little bit better on through that, the earlier in the process that we're able to be involved with the customer in collaboration.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think it earlier is always works better because automation is built over time and you have to do things in a certain order, right? You can't paint and plate at the same time, right?
Right. I mean, I think sometimes I look at it as a general contractor, integrator, as a general contractor, say on your house. I mean, the general contractor may offer you some more cost-effective ways to do some things or some different options if you get them involved in earlier in the process, say when you're designing the home, as opposed to when you're already done and you've already got your mind set on what you want it to be. Then I think you kind of, you know, you get stuck in some things that way that maybe could have been a little better or a little more cost effective for you.
Let's talk then about the customer specification document. How does that happen and what happens if a customer doesn't have one?
Yeah, so of course, many large customers, especially automotive, the medical device folks, they're, you know, typically always going to have a pretty detailed specification and many chapters or volumes to that, you know, may have specific specifications for electrical and controls and another kind of subset of specifications that relate to mechanical design and tooling design and things of that nature. They may have another specification that is specific for their CAD requirements and how their drawings need to look. So yeah, there are certainly those customers that have a detailed specification, and they usually have a detailed statement of work of what the processes look like, the metrics required, the acceptance requirements, you know, possibly even a preliminary concept that they would like to be quoted. Most typically, customers are open to accepting alternate proposals, even if they do have a preliminary concept. You know, obviously, unless it's something they've done before and they know this is what works and they know what they want, and then, you know, if they prescribe it that way, then, you know, that's the way we would typically go. Given those customers who aren't big and don't have those sort of things at their disposal, we have a standard checklist we normally go through to ask the sort of questions that will allow us to kind of generate a specification document that can then be utilized between us and the customer to generate our proposal. And then in effect, our proposal then becomes somewhat of a de facto specification as well. And that's what, as we proceed through the project after purchase order, then, you know, that's what we would perform to, and that's what would become the expectations of the project.
Thanks, Lyle. Hey, can you explain the difference between budgetary and firm when it comes to a quotation document?
Sure. You know, there are different levels of quotes depending on the stage of the process that a customer might be in. Budgetary quotes are less detailed and are intended to provide a general ballpark price to a customer who may be in the planning stages of the capital buy process. They need to get a number that they can take to management and to reference in capital funding approvals or internal analysis of whether to move forward with the project. Firm quotes are generally provided when a customer has funding available, they have a go project, and they need to get those, say, three quotes for purchasing so that, you know, they can identify and select the best possible solution and cost. And here's where we want to be more accurate, where we might have had a plus or minus 15 or 20% variation on the budgetary quote. We need to be nailed down, and we need to go out and get firm pricing for, say, more costly components. Like, we need to know what we're going to have to pay for a robot. We need to know what we're going to have to pay for a vibratory feeder, for example. We need to get some quotes from our suppliers, say, for a custom conveyor. Some of those bigger ticket items, we need to have those nailed down and not just kind of guess at those numbers. We also may do some more conceptual work, you know, put some designs together, say, for a concept layout, or we may do some conceptual design for end of arm tooling, or some other things, just to make sure that in that firm proposal stage, we got things nailed down quite a bit more, because the expectation on the customer side is that they're going to buy it for that price. Whereas in the budgetary stage, we may know that, hey, there's some movement on that number up or down a little bit. Another one that we didn't, that is kind of in the budgetary range, or budgetary realm, I should say, that we often get into is, and it's more when a salesman might just give a number, kind of, I say off the cuff, but an educated guess on a number that's a bigger, chunkier number even than a budgetary number, but we call it a rough order of magnitude, where a customer's just wanting to say, hey, look, we're just kind of talking about automation. I just need to know, hey, is this $250,000, or is it $500,000, or is it $1 million? So those are kind of the three levels of quotes that we kind of look at in our business.
Lyle, do you ever do this when you're in a factory? You walk by a piece of automation, maybe you look it over a couple of times and say, hey, this is a $750,000 piece of automation?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I think that's a lot of times what, you know, when we talk about these rough order of magnitude things, is because we want to know in our mind kind of what numbers, you know, what the value of what we're proposing looks like, because we also have to consider how the customer is going to pay for this. What's their return on investment? So we have to have that idea in mind as we're quoting, so that we don't quote something that's overkill, knowing that their budget is, say, for a, you know, $250,000 machine, that we don't put in, you know, some used technology, or, you know, add additional features that may be great features, but they're not 100% necessary, which drive the cost out of their budget.
I just wondered if I was the only guy who run around and take a look at what these numbers are.
No, absolutely not.
I mean, I'm glad I got a company. Hey, let's talk about prototype automation and kind of customer risk reduction, because this works for both sides, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's things and there's processes that, you know, it helps us to verify solutions for risky or unknown parts of the process as early as possible in the schedule. You know, this helps us to minimize the amount of rework we might run into later. It allows for a more robust and efficient overall solution when we are able to know and understand some of these riskier unknown processes early on. And machine vision is a great example of a technology that lends itself really well to prototyping. And that's mainly because you can relatively easily do benchtop testing with machine vision. You know, as a matter of fact, we have machine vision, vision cameras and lighting setups and everything. And typically on any vision project that we're doing, we want to do feasibility studies even as early as the quotation stage to understand, can we see these features of this part that the customer is requesting, you know, whether it be from a quality standpoint, or just a lot of times the vision is used for verifying that a parts of an assembly have been assembled and assembled correctly, you know, and other things are, you know, you're seeing a lot more of like 2D barcode matrices printed or stamped or laser etched onto parts for part traceability. And, you know, we want to see that with a, you know, vision upgrades. It's relatively simple to do that up front and determine, hey, I can see that code. I can see it well. There's, you know, it's not a marginal application, things of that nature. And then, you know, this just takes one aspect of it and solidifies it to the point where we can focus our time and energy on other things throughout the process.
Can you talk a little bit about when we're talking about things like PLCs and part feeders, and these are third-party or long lead items?
I guess first, long lead is kind of can be a somewhat nebulous terminology. It's difficult to put a hard and fast number on this for every project. It might be somewhat different for every project. And so the project manager needs to evaluate their project schedule and determine what long lead might mean for this particular project. You know, I think typically when we look at that, me as a project manager anyway, I would say, from the time I complete engineering to the time I want to start assembling this automation, you know, there's a gap where I'm purchasing equipment and, you know, starting assembly. So the thing I'd like to drive that is the time it takes me to manufacture and machine custom details. You know, typically in most projects I've been involved with, at least, you're going to look at that window of being like 6 to 8 weeks. So that, I think, if you were to try and pick a number, I would say anything longer than 6 to 8 weeks, we're going to say is a long lead item on a typical project. You know, so some of the things that might have been long lead items in the past, like robot suppliers, are doing a much better job of, over the years, of identifying high volume models and having models built up in certain configurations in their pipeline. And, you know, keeping those inventory levels and manufacturing levels high. So we're, you know, I don't think robots are one of those things that anymore, at least for the more common and widely used models, you know, have very reasonable lead times. Vibratory feeders might be a prime example of something that is a longer lead time. And, you know, this is really due to, that's a, typically, unless you're doing something that's like a screw, a standard screw, you know, when we're looking at vibratory feeders of other components, you know, you have an engineering time and you have a development time that's required to complete and verify the operation of a feeder bowl. And many times that will take thousands of part cycles through a feeder to get that process right. And it's a process of, you know, a lot of rework involved just by the nature of it to get a vibratory feeder working correctly. So I think the long lead time items typically come in when there's an engineering component to it. I think any more things even that are coming from internationally, I don't think we're seeing the long lead times that we did maybe in years past. So I think it's more typically something that has an engineering or a custom component to it that creates the long lead time issues.
That's good to know. Thank you, Al. So one of the questions I have is kind of who chooses what, like a conveyor system or a sensor or even a PLC?
Well, especially on things like sensors and PLC components, many customers have distinct preferences on that, on those sorts of things, and robots fall into that category as well. And that's mainly because they have engineers or maintenance personnel that have distinct experiences and knowledge base. And they may have those components already in their facility in many automation cells already. So which case a lot of companies will keep an inventory of spare parts on hand. So in that case, the customer will drive the selection of PLCs and sensors that they're comfortable with, they're familiar with, and they have a preference for. That may be true for something like a conveyor system, but not as much, I wouldn't say. And in that case, and for other things where a customer doesn't have a preference, we as an integrator are going to look for the things where we have a knowledge base and we have experiences, and we've built our preferences based on past successes and failures and in the support level that we get, which is another factor also for customers. They want to buy sensors that they get good support from their local distributor, if they have an issue or they need to purchase components and things of that nature. They want to, that local support is very important to them. As it is to us, we rely on our local support system as well when we're doing designing and building systems for things that problems and issues that come up and also for our cost base as well.
Thank you, Lyle. What's one of the questions I was asking? You talked about project management, and you're the applications engineer, of course. And when you land a project, when somebody decides to send you a purchase order, what's the handoff between the apps and the PM look like?
This is obviously a key event for a successful project launch. There's been a lot of during the course of the quotation process, and many times there's a lot of iterations that occur. It's not often that we quote something one time and the customer buys that. There's many times where we have two, three, or more revisions to a quote along the way before we, get that collaboration correctly and the customer's happy and satisfied that the layout configuration and things of that nature are all correct. So, during that time, there may be many communications, emails, phone calls, visits to the customer, things of that nature that occur. We want to make sure that we get all of that, those preliminary concepts, the communications, why we moved from one concept to another concept, and make sure that the project team has that final revision and that's what they're focused on. But they also understand some of the hurdles and some of the things that were pushback points from the customer. And so that thorough and complete handoff just helps us to alleviate confusion and unnecessary conflicts as we move into the project operation phase.
So I'm a customer and I've just bought this automation system from you. I've sent you a purchase order, and now it comes to design. And design approvals. How can you tell the audience what that kind of looks like?
Yeah, so the other thing, once that application handoff to project management has occurred, one of the first thing the project team wants to do is get that meeting with the customer and have a kickoff meeting with that customer to make sure we all understand things the same way. And there's there may be new team members on the customer side that are being brought on board, and we want to get the team members synced up and their counterparts within our organization. Say, for instance, the person on the customer end that may be responsible for the controls piece of the automation, there may be a different person that we want to speak to for safety and ergo issues and things of that nature. So we want to make sure we get that involvement and that engagement from the customer early on. And we've found over the years that the advent of the web-based conference calling has allowed us to keep the customer in the loop much more efficiently throughout the stages of the design process. In the way we would do that is have, a weekly conference call where we're able to share our screen and share the process of the particular station design that may be coming together. And we can then typically run into questions of, should I go this direction or go that direction, or select this component versus that component, or this particular design, you know, there's maybe a couple different ways we could design a particular piece of tooling. And we have these web-based designs and you share it on the screen, then things become more clear to the customer and we're able to resolve some of these things in real time. And then when we get to that approval stage, then it's more just a affirmation of what we've been seeing week in and week out in these weekly conference calls. You know, and I think this sort of involvement also allows the customer to get more people involved on their end. Say, for instance, the safety folks or the operators or the maintenance personnel. Whereas, you know, in times past, you know, it'd be a lot of times you didn't have this designer. You went and traveled to the customer, or the customer traveled to your facility to do a design review. And oftentimes that didn't facilitate getting the maximum number of people involved just because of the travel logistics and things of that nature. So I think this allows a more complete involvement and engagement from both sides of it. And then when we get to that approval stage, what we mean by approval is, hey, we're all agreeing that these stations are meeting the expectations of the process and of what has been sold. So the customer is getting what they believe they purchased, and they believe that it's will function to do the, you know, what they expect it to do. And at that stage, once we have those design approvals, then we would go on and finish our detailed design for the custom details and things of that nature, and actually create those drawings so that then we can get fabrication and machining completed.
I totally agree with you. I think that, you know, by having these virtual technologies, people like health and safety and maintenance and such have that opportunity to chime in where they normally wouldn't be allowed out of the factory long enough to travel for a couple of days. Let's talk about the fabrication, the integration, and the build.
Okay. You know, there's certainly many of the items that require a certain sequence in fabrication and machining. I mean, you have different processes that may be required. You know, we may need to fabricate a steel tubular frame for our machine base. And part of that is we need to get a Blanchard ground steel plate. So, you know, those sort of things like that can be occurring in parallel. So we're fabricating the machine base frame, welding it together while the steel base plate for the tabletop is being made separately, and then the two get married together at some point. Another prime example would be a tooling detail that needs to be hardened for production operation. So many times, let's say it's maybe a press operation, we might take a detail like that, machine it in a soft state, and possibly assemble it to the machine, to the press, and test it out, make sure that it fits and it functions as we expect it to. And at that point, we would take it off and send it to heat treat to harden it. So in that way, if we did have to make some tweaks to it to send it back to machining, for example, we'd be doing it in a soft state as opposed to a hardened state. Then, of course, you need to allow time for painting. We would typically want to paint any items that need to be painted prior to assembly and debug so that things don't need to be taken back apart after the assembly and debug process to go through painting.
And so then the next step is really about the runoff and the factory acceptance testing. So what does that look like, and how long does it take?
Well, I don't think there's necessarily a hard and fast number for that. I think it's going to runoff and acceptance testing provides a demonstration of the operational characteristics of the automation equipment. It allows the customer an opportunity to ensure that what they purchased is what they're getting, that it functions the way they expect it to. So obviously for a more complex assembly line, multiple stations, that may take longer to perform that runoff than say a single station piece of automation that doesn't have as many components and things to verify. The other thing is what level of expectation is there from the customer for runoff? You know, many of the big customers, the automotives and the medical type folks, have very detailed and very extensive runoff and acceptance testing specifications. They may come in and have a checklist of things where they're just going around and doing visual checks for the better part of a day before you even begin to run the equipment. Certainly there's things in any runoff we want to verify, certain operational characteristics, which typically include safety features, manual and automatic functional control, fault capture, fault recovery, cycle time, process capability. And, you know, we typically would start a runoff with the demonstration of these safety features and progress on through a fully automatic simulation of production. And the reason we want to start with the safety aspects is many times customers will bring their own operators to run the system. And we want to ensure from our standpoint, as well as the customers, that everybody's comfortable that whoever's going to operate this system for this demonstration is going to be able to do it in a safe way. Oftentimes, there's also something we refer to as a dry cycle, which is essentially operating the parts and going through their functional motion, but not without parts present. We're not actually producing a part off of the automation. The machines are just, and the automation is just going through the motions it would be without parts. And many times, especially a requirement in automotive, is you may have as many as 20 hours of dry cycle required as part of your runoff. Now, many times we're able to do that without the customer present and maybe provide a video of that or just a log report of what occurred during that dry cycle. But to answer your question, how long a runoff takes, you know, it could be anywhere from a few hours to maybe even as long as a week, depending on the complexity and level of acceptance testing required.
Thanks, Lyle. I'm pretty sure that there's no two runoffs that are exactly the same, and it's almost like asking how long a piece of string is. What are the things that, so we're getting now, the bubble is moving through the shop here. So what about operator training?
Yeah, I think training in general in organizations is probably one of those things that's been put on the back burner due to budget cuts and things of that nature. But I think it's a key component for operational efficiency and effectiveness. I think it makes the operators better prepared to react and recover from machine faults and quality issues. I think one of the things that's more of a soft feature of it is it gives the operator a better understanding of why the machine does certain things in certain ways. And it gives it, you know, which in turn, I think, gives them ideas for improvements. Because in the end, they're the ones that may have been doing this production process that we're now automating. They may have been doing it for years. So they understand about the parts. They understand the process probably as well as anyone. And, you know, oftentimes they are willing and able to provide some very good input through the process to make things the best they can be. And I think it also, another key component is giving the operator a greater sense of being a part of the team and the automation team, you know, and enhances their ownership of the automation, which can be very key to the success or failure of automation projects.
No, those are all good points. So we're getting closer to the end of the bubble. What about commissioning? And so that's the whole idea of breaking down the line, putting on a truck and setting it back up wherever it's going to live.
Yeah, typically the automation projects we're involved with, they have some form of installation and startup assistance that is included in our proposals. And certainly, the more the equipment is operated, the more chance you have to discover issues or specific runtime scenarios. And many times, you cannot fully simulate the full production process on our floor, which means there's areas of this that are only going to be seen for the first time once it's set up and actually producing parts on the customer floor. other things that may occur is, you know, batch runs of parts. You know, if we run off and do debug and acceptance testing on a certain batch of parts, and then, you know, you get a new batch of parts in, you may discover issues related to part variations that were not evident previously on your smaller sample size. For that reason, we typically provide support throughout that installation and startup process, you know, and that's where we may get the time to optimize cycle times, for instance, and confirm that data collection is occurring properly. You know, a lot of the things of that nature can only occur fully once things are installed on the customer floor and producing parts.
I agree with you. That's one of the big challenges in automated manufacturing, is making sure that your parts are consistent and they're in spec, and you're not changing part manufacturers like after you get an automation system so much. These are very, very important. So the last thing then, and we were going to talk about this kind of in detail. So instruction manuals, what happens with that? I know it's very important to some companies, less important to others.
You know, certainly instruction manuals still exist, and they're a key part of the solution. Much like, you know, even your car, for instance, you know, you want to be able to look up in the manual how to operate certain features, and you know, we want to provide something that affords our customers the opportunity to support their equipment, be that first line of defense, and be able to resolve things and get things back up and running quickly and efficiently, because the automation equipment is not paying them back unless it's operating at full capacity and as much as possible. It used to be when we would provide manuals, it would be, you know, we need 3 hard copy sets of the manuals and the drawings and the programs. You know, anymore today, it's, you know, everybody just wants the electronic version of things, and you know, they can print out copies as they see fit. You know, another thing you see now too is some of the HMIs devices actually, you have PCs built into them, and you will see customers having their drawings available that an operator or a maintenance personnel can actually pull the drawing up at the machine. So they don't have to go find this drawing in the archives and, you know, then search through it. They have those updated drawings and the updated manual right there at the HMI, and they can pull these things up and read what they need to read, or follow the instructions they need to follow, or troubleshoot something on a drawing right there at the machine.
No, that makes a lot of sense. You know, nothing worse than being a maintenance person on an automation system and having to search around for the sensor bracket drawing or whatever that is that you're trying to replace. Hey, this has been really interesting, Lyle. I'd like to thank you for taking time out of your day to chat with our audience. Lyle, some of our listeners might have some other questions or might need to understand more about buying an automation system. How can people get in touch with you?
You can reach me via email at lweaver, that's lweaver, at airheartsolutions.com. And my phone number is 937-703-5246. And of course, feel free, you can find me on LinkedIn as well. Feel free to reach out and connect, and be happy to talk to you anytime.
I would like to thank and acknowledge our partner, A3, the Association for Advancing Automation. A3 is the umbrella association for the RIA, AIA, MCMA, and A3 Mexico. These 4 associations combined represent almost 1,300 automation manufacturers, component suppliers, systems integrators, end users, research groups, and consulting firms throughout the world that are driving automation forward. I'd also like to thank and recognize our partner, Painted Robot. Painted Robot builds and integrates digital solutions. They're a web development firm that offers SEO and digital social marketing, and can set up and connect CRM and other ERP tools to unify marketing, sales, and operations. As web and digital is changing, Painted Robot is helping advanced manufacturers stay modern and competitive in the space. You can find Painted Robot at paintedrobot.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us at the Robot Industry Podcast, our email address is therobotindustrypodcast@gmail.com, or you can find me, Jim Beretta, on LinkedIn. If you have an idea, an interesting company or technology, or would like to be a guest or nominate someone to be a guest, please send me an email. We'll see you next time, and thanks for listening. Be safe out there. Today's podcast was produced by Customer Traction, and I'd like to thank my nephew, Chris Gray, for the music, Chris Colvin for the audio production, my partner, Janet, and our sponsors, A3 and Painted Robot.